The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
All right, just to fill you in on what we're going to do now, we're going to be heading off the Golan Heights. And even though we're going down, this is what's called in mystical circles, Yirida Letzorech Aliyah. We are going down in order to go back up. So we're going to be coming off the Golan Heights. We'll actually be heading north of the Kinneret, and then going back up towards the holy mystical city of Tzfat. Now, I want you to know, you really can't fit Tzfat into this day. In fact, when we get to the restaurant, they're going to be a little bit annoyed because we're going to be an hour late. So really, if we had a month and we were spending a week in Tzfat, there'd be a lot to see. We're only going to have a couple hours in Tzfat. So this is the ultimate, the paradigm of the example of just whetting your appetite so that you'll come back and visit. If you've never been to Tzfat, this will blow your mind. If you've been to Tzfat, it might annoy you, because how come we're only here for a couple hours? By the way, you're all adults. One of the nice things about not having a teen group is if anyone wants to stay in Tzfat and skip dinner and get back to Yerushalayim on your own or catch a ride, you're more than welcome to do it. Just make sure to let me know. I don't mind. I've had that happen before. One of the nice things about Tzfat is you don't have to plan where you're staying. Yeah, you just walk around the street and say, I need a place to stay. You get all sorts of strange offers. Anyway, I mean that in a good way. Anyway, so we're going to go to Tzfat. Here's how we're going to do it, okay? We, after Tzfat, are going to be heading down to Tveria for dinner, which will position us to head back after dinner to Yerushalayim. Dinner is a treat, trust me. Having said that, and I never know this until I get to Tzfat. Tzfat is a very holy place. It's a city of the mystics, and that's why every time you go there, they change the traffic directions. They change street orders. It used to be you go around to the right, now it's a one-way street the wrong way. Then a year later, they turn it back that way. I'm not sure what's going on there. So I never know what's going to be until I get to Tzfat. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to offer you two options. Okay? One option is to take a tour of the old city of Tzfat and an overview of the graveyard. Some of the stories, and if you've been to Tzfat like plenty of times, you may want to skip that because I don't know if there's anything new that I'll have to share with you, but that's your choice. The other option is I'm going to point out to you the artist quarter, which is beautiful. It's potluck what's open and what isn't, but usually July in the afternoon you should have pretty much all the galleries open because tourism is back in style. There are mystics who sell mystical artwork, beautiful sculptures, paintings, all sorts of stuff. There's a candle factory. You look out for the sign. You can visit. They make candles that are incredible. And the third option is you can head up the hill towards the newer city of Tzfat. And, you know, if you want to just do some regular hanging out, grab a cup of coffee, shopping, etc. I would not suggest the third option because you can do that in Yerushalayim. But that's your call. If you've kind of had a long day and you just want to have a chill and a cup of coffee, you can do that too. Okay? The base that we're passing on our left, among other things, is also a resupply base. And they have an area in the center of this base where they actually fix tank engines. It's one of the lessons we learned from the Yom Kippur War. It made sense originally, you know, since we had American tanks, that when we brought spare parts in, we stored them near the coastal region, right? Near the, you know, the ports of Ashkelon or Ashdod or Tel Aviv, because that way when you need a tank engine, you don't know where you need it. Maybe you need it down in Sinai, maybe you need it up in, you know, wherever. So if you can store it there and just ship it wherever you need it, you end up needing less tank engines because you don't have to store so many so many tank engines. So, of course, the problem is that in the Yom Kippur War, when a tank gets stalled or a tank engine is blown up, you don't have the time that it takes to get a new tank engine up on a trailer and up into the Golan Heights. And this was a critical factor in the Yom Kippur War. So they decided to build bases up here that could actually refurbish the tank. Today, Israel has the fastest turnaround tank for tank repairs, turnaround time, both in tanks and in the Air Force, in the world. We can take a tank, refit it with a new engine completely, which is a very complicated thing, in under 6 hours. Yes. New engine, ready to roll under 6 hours. Crew of four. You can see a Centurion tank. This base is the 188th Brigade, and the memorial on the right is the memorial to the men of the 188th who fell in the Yom Kippur War. The unit has since been rebuilt and refurbished. You can see another memorial here. It's called the Barak Brigade. Okay, we're gonna give you a couple of visitors. You don't know what a big mitzvah is? Take two soldiers on a Thursday. They're going home for Shabbos. Look where we are in the middle of nowhere. Okay, guys, these are tankers. These are from the elite units of the Israeli army. Everybody knows that infantrymen are nebuchs and the tanks know how to ride. These guys are from the brigade that I've been telling you about all day, the 188th.
They don't have 11 left at the end of the...
No, that was from the 7th brigade. You should know that they probably just finished Tipul Shui, which is working on their tanks to clean them up after the week. So they're much more happy to see you than you are to see them, believe me. Maybe offer them a cold drink, some fruit. By the way, on the right is a stream called the Jilabun, which is a beautiful nachal, beautiful stream that you walk through the mountains. Also really, really worth coming to, very easy to get to. Okay, here we go. This is Beit HaMeches. This is where the Syrians collected tax from anybody who came through the area. And this was also a Syrian army base. First of all, I want you to know that we're coming off, we're passing a place called Mitzpeh Gadot, the overlook of Gadot. The kibbutz of Gadot is below us, right? Moshav Gadot. And the belly of Israel, all of the yeshivim, the kibbutzim that we spoke about, we're now on the northern edge of the Golan Heights, okay? And if you look on the right, you can see very clearly as we wind down that there is a monument. Looks like a half a staircase going up into the sky. That is the edge of a Syrian bunker position. And the Israelis had to come up here in 67, and they had to take that bunker. It was a very, very difficult battle. I'll point out when we pass by in a second that, first of all, look how this bunker position overlooks the valley. They found the pages where they had the coordinates for every kibbutz, every moshav in the area for the artillery guns that were up here, including they marked off children's nursery school, school building, dining room. They knew exactly what was what, when people were there, and they used to target them. After the Six-Day War, Dado Elazar, the Ramatkal, the chief of staff of the Israeli army, came up here for a visit, now that this sort of wasn't Syria and became Israel. And he looked from this mountain, and he looked down in the valleys, and all of a sudden he really understood what the people who were living here had been going through. And he said, Mipo atem nirim shivatayim. From here, you seem seven times as big. He was doing a play on the fact that the kibbutzim seem so small from up here, but they're really so big. And another interesting thing that you'll notice here is the trees. Notice how there's like no trees. Notice there's like a few trees growing here. Right? Pardon? There was a big fire here. By the way, this is again a minefield, because this is the entrance to a Syrian bunker position. And if you look on your right, you will see the edge of the bunker position, thick, 4 foot thick concrete under here, the totally impregnable from the air. In any event, you'll see that there are little clumps of trees, eucalyptus trees. And you're like, what are they doing in the middle of nowhere? So I'll tell you an interesting story. In the 1960s, there was an Egyptian Jew who looked very Arabic, spoke perfect Arabic, and was recruited into the Israeli secret service, the Mossad. And eventually he went undercover as an Israeli agent. Now he couldn't be in Egypt, it was too dangerous because he had grown up in Egypt. So he went to Syria. And he was Israel's top spy. His cover was that he was a businessman. He was given large amounts of money, which he splashed around and threw parties. And he became close with the elite of Syrian society. He, among other things, was very close with Mustafa Klass, who would later become very high up in the government of Syria. His position was so strong, and he was so accepted in the Syrian elite circles, that that he was recommended as the next Minister of Defense of Syria. Can you imagine? Can you imagine an Israeli agent as the defense minister? Anyway, because he was so high up and he was close and he, procured arms and all sorts of things, so he was constantly going on tours of the military bases. And he came up one day with a brilliant idea. He said, you know, all your soldiers, they're sitting out here, they're baking in the sun, they're constantly looking for shade, so they don't stay by their machine gun positions. Why don't you plant trees, plant eucalyptus trees, they go very quickly, plant these trees over the Syrian gun positions, and first of all, then they'll have shade, so they'll want to stay by their guns. Second of all, they'll be protected from the air, you won't be able to see them. They loved this idea. Brilliant. So they planted eucalyptus trees over gun positions all over the Golan Heights. And 3 years later, in the Six-Day War, when the Israeli Air Force came to bomb the Golan Heights as a precursor to the attack, they simply bombed all the eucalyptus tree positions, and they knocked out a huge portion of the Syrian positions before they even started. This man's name was Eli Cohen. Eli Cohen was captured. I'll tell you the story of how he was captured, but I have to interrupt the story in order to tell you where we are. We are about to cross over a bridge called Gesher Bnot Yaakov. Okay? See if you can guess why the driver is driving slowly. That is the Jordan River below us. And those are the rafting people. You can do that. Raft on the Jordan River. Now this is really important. Look behind you on the ridge. Do you see that ridge?
Yes.
Okay? On the morning after the Yom Kippur War started, when the final remnants of the 77th Battalion were wiped out, the 188th was gone, the Syrian armor reached this ridge. It reached the bridge of Bnot Yaakov. We've crossed over the Jordan River. This is a tremendously difficult crossing point. There are only two bridges here. Okay? There's another bridge called Gesher Arik, and that's it. So a small unit can hold off a huge force. But if they can get over this bridge, that's it. They're near Katrin, they're near Rosh Pina, they're 40 minutes from Tzfat, half an hour from Tveria, this is it. And for some mysterious reason, the Syrian troops stop. Hundreds and hundreds of tank on the ridges across just stop on the morning after Yom Kippur and wait. And they wait for almost 24 hours. And by the time they resume, the reserves have begun to arrive, and they're able to hold the line and eventually to turn the tide. And this is a mystery. Look at this gun position. And this is a mystery. Why did the Syrian troops stop? Now I'm interrupting the first story, which I interrupted the second story, just to show you something on the right, which will lead you to the third story. This is Mishmar HaYarden, and this stands protectively over the Jordan River. This is the unknown Six-Day War. In 1948, the Syrian armor under Tufik Hawazi reached this area. They were at the top of the Kinneret, and they were spread, set to go down the road we're going to take, all the way down. There's nothing to stop them, just like in 73. And they would have taken Tveria, they would have taken the Kinneret, they would have been able to get all the way to Yerushalayim. So they sent an urgent order to Mishmar HaYarden, to this kibbutz, which was the guard post of the Jordan, that's what its name means, to try to hold them up. And they sent 12 additional fighters from the area, Palmachnikim, to support them. And they fought a pitched battle, machine guns against tanks, for 6 days. They held them off for 6 whole days. At the end of 6 days, the kibbutz fell. All the men who were left were slaughtered. But by the time the kibbutz fell, the Israelis had succeeded in bringing up reinforcements, and they held off the Syrians, turned the tide, and the state of Israel survived. And after the war was over, they came back to build a memorial to the men and women of Mishmar HaYarden who had saved the state of Israel. And they dug up some of the remains, and they found an incredible thing. They found that Mishmar HaYarden was sitting on top of a Tannaitic village from the period of the Mishnah. And you can see some of the remnants there. And so eventually some of the children of those fighters, just like Hushatun, came back and rebuilt Mishmar HaYarden, but they built it in a more strategically viable place further up the hill. Back to the second story, or the first story, Eli Cohen. So Eli Cohen is a high spy way up there in the Syrian echelon, and one night in the middle of the night, he's sending radio messages. Now, the way that you would send radio messages back then, you had to have a frequency. How do you find a frequency? Normally, the government controls all frequencies. So they were able to discover the frequency of one of the embassies. I believe it was the Danish embassy. And they would pick an hour when no one could possibly be sending a radio message, 3 o'clock in the morning, and that's when they would sort of spread their messages. Anyway, one morning, Eli Cohen, 3 o'clock in the morning, was sending a radio message, and he's using the frequency of the Danish embassy. He doesn't realize that they've got some urgent message, and the Danes are trying to send a message, and their frequency is being jammed. So they complain to the Syrian Defense Ministry. And eventually, the Syrians realize that something's going on, somebody's sending radio messages. So they send a triangulator, which is a special van that can locate the source of radio frequencies. And they begin to zero in. And one morning, unbeknownst to the fact that there is a triangulator parked right down the street from his apartment, Eli Cohen begins to send messages. The Syrian police burst into his apartment at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they catch him in the middle of sending a radio transmission. Now, if they had caught him and he didn't have a radio there, he didn't, whatever, he would have had plausible deniability. They never would have believed it was him. You know? It'd be like accusing Al Gore or someone like that, or Bill Clinton, of selling secrets to the enemy. Like, it's got to be a mistake. Right? So, they caught him al-Kham Mashiach. And because they caught him red-handed, he had no deniability. 6 hours after he was captured, he was being tortured in the prison cells of the Damascus prison. He was tortured for 3 days. At the end of 3 days of torture, he stood trial. He refused to admit his guilt, although he did admit to being Israeli. His trial lasted a few hours. He had no defense attorney. And he was sentenced to death. Telegrams came from all over the world, including the Queen of England, begging for his pardon. The Syrians refused to relent. And in the year 1964, Eli Cohen was hung in a sack like a dog in the main square of Damascus while his wife watched on TV in Israel. They took his bones and they buried them with the bones of dogs in an unmarked grave in a cemetery in Damascus. And to this day, we're talking now almost 40 years later, over 40 years later, Israel is still trying to get his body back. But it is absolutely because of Eli Cohen and his heroism that the Six-Day War was won, and that we were able to tour the Golan Heights today. So when you pass those special trees, it's something to think about. I'll tell you an amazing story. Hang on one sec. What happened? Are we leaving
them? No, they're leaving them. חבר'ה, תודה רבה. שבת שלום.
ביי, ביי.
בהצלחה.
Remember his story about that bird?
Yeah.
That's a weird story, man. We just passed through Rosh Pina. I think you should be able to get your last view of the Kinneret in a minute. We just passed through Rosh Pina, which is the first modern settlement, when sort of Israel began to be resettled in the 1800s. Actually, an interesting story. They were looking for a place to buy a synagogue, to build a synagogue. So they came to the Arab Sheikh because there was a field that was called Wacht al Yahud. It's called the Field of the Jews. So they asked the Sheikh, like the head of the town. Yeah, there was an Arab town above Rosh Pina, and they said, "What is this Field of the Jews?" He said, "I don't know. It's always been called the Field of the Jews." So they said, "Well, if it's been called the Field of the Jews, maybe the Jews should come back and settle it. We're looking for a place to build a synagogue." He said, "Well, it's empty land, and we believe it's inhabited by ghosts. So no Arabs will build there. So if you want to buy it, we'll sell it to you." All right, thank you very much. Okay. So they buy this. They buy this field, and eventually they raise enough money, and they start to build a synagogue. And when they're digging the foundations, can you guess what they find? A mikveh. They find a mikveh. The mikveh leads them to actually a Jewish cemetery, which leads them to a community. Rosh Pina was built. Now, Rosh Pina was a secular town. The reason they were building a synagogue was because there was someone on the board who felt every city in Israel should have a synagogue, so the Jews of all kinds could visit there. It was a secular town, and they were sort of getting away from religion and getting away from the darkness of the past. We're going to rebuild a modern state, and here they are, they're coming back, and they're rebuilding Rosh Pina, on the site of a village that existed in the time of the temple. It's just mind-boggling. And you know what the problem is? You come to Israel, you spend a week here, you keep hearing these stories, so you're like, oh yeah, sure, sure, the village built on top of the temple, right, got it. But that's unbelievable. That's just unbelievable. And that they happened to build their synagogue in the exact spot where there was a mikveh. Anyway, which by the way meant that they didn't have to build a mikveh, it saved them a lot of money. It just refurbished, and today you can use this mikveh, which is a 2,300-year-old mikveh.
Wow.
Oh, I finally got a wow. Okay, we got a wow. Anyway, back to our original story. So why did they stop? It was a mystery. They stopped for 24 hours. There is no doubt in anybody's mind that had they continued for those 24 hours, they would absolutely have crushed Israel. I mean, they would have gone straight through the heart of Israel. They would have reached all the major cities. And you have to understand, there were full divisions of tanks with no one to stop them. So this became an interesting question. Why did the Syrians stop? So one theory was that they thought it was a trap. They just couldn't imagine that they had actually gotten through so easily, that in one day they had crushed the Israeli army. So they thought the Israelis were trapping them, and they were going to go across the river, cut them in half, whatever. But there is another possibility. And this possibility is a little weird. I tell you in advance that if I had not seen this with my own eyes, I would not believe it. And since it's been it's over 20 years, except I wonder if I really saw this, but I really saw this. So, see these trees, by the way? Okay, so I really saw this. So back in 1984, that has nothing to do with the story, I just thought you wanted to notice the trees. Anyway, so, I mean, part of the set, I've got to create trees. Anyway, in 1984, there's an officer's course. And there's this section of the course where you're back on the base, and you have to learn how to prepare and plan military strategy. So you basically have to choose a battle from Israel's military history. You have to analyze it, and you have to see where the defects and the faults were, and how you could fix it, and what mistakes were made, and how we could learn from it, and what you would be your strategic recommendations or whatever. And it's a very long, very complicated project. And it takes a lot of research because you have to know every detail of the battle, and you get quizzed on it, right? And you get marked on it. So I had this great idea. I thought, you know what? One of the battles in the book of Yeshua that fascinates me is the story of Ai. Okay, Ai is the second battle. This battle goes wrong. It goes wrong ostensibly because Achan stole and God is punishing them. But, you know, there's also a strategic story. And the whole story of Ai is contained in less than one chapter of the book of Yeshua. Fascinating story. So I came to my commanders and I said, look, I would like to do a story from the battle history of the Jewish people. And I'm wondering if, you know, you say from the Israeli army, well, this was an Israeli army. Can I analyze the battle of the story of Ai? So my commander loved the idea. He got it approved by the battalion commander. And I got to do the story of Ai. Now, of course, the story of Ai is like 20 verses. It's in one place in Joshua. I was pretty much guaranteed that the people who would be marking this paper did not know the book of Joshua. And if they did, they didn't have time to study all the commentaries. So this is like a no-brainer. So I basically finished my three-day project in about 6 hours. Right? Got a perfect score because I didn't get anybody fail Joshua, right? And now I had like a couple days with nothing to do. So every day we were all in the military library with all the files of all the battle reports. So I was like a boy in a candy store. I just started reading through reports and files, became fascinated with the Yom Kippur War. And at one point I started reading interrogation reports from the Yom Kippur War. At the end of the Yom Kippur War, we captured a large number of Syrian soldiers and officers, including one colonel who was the adjutant to Rifat Asad. Now Rifat Asad was the brother of Hafez Asad, past president of Syria. Because he was the brother of the president, he was also the commander of the president's guard, and he was responsible for the units that were protecting Damascus. And just before the Yom Kippur War, he was appointed in charge of the division that spearheaded the attack against the Jews. Okay? So, this fellow was the adjutant of that Rifat Asad, right? And they were interrogating him about his role in the battles and everything. And at one point they said to him, so, why did they stop? By the way, we've entered the city of Tzfat. This is the newest section of the city above. So, They wanted to know why Syrian armor stopped the bridge of Minot Yaakov. So he told the following story, and I remember. This is in a... I'm sitting in a military base. I'm sitting in a military war library in the base that is the base of officers' course down south, the entire Israeli army. This is not like, you know, Shlomo Kalbach's crunchy granola, you know. I mean, this is the Israeli army. So he tells this amazing story. He says that Rifat Asad was a very superstitious man. Now, we know this is true, by the way. Because one of the things they teach you is that when you're up in the Golan, if you see Syrian tanks and they're parked a certain way, facing the direction of the sun, that's because Rifat Asad is very suspicious, he's very superstitious, and all his tanks have to park that way, facing the sun, all sorts of weird things. So this is like known. So, guy says, the night before the Yom Kippur War, Rifat Asad has a dream. In the dream, an old man with a white beard comes to him, and he believes it was one of his ancestors. And that this old man tells Rifat Asad that he should have confidence in their battle, and that they will sweep through the Israeli forces, but at a certain point he will have a chance to pursue further, and that he should wait 24 hours because it's a trick. And that if he will proceed ahead, he will be destroyed, and his entire army will be destroyed with him. But if he waits for 24 hours, for a day, right, then no one will attack him, and whatever happens to his unit, right, he will survive the war. So if you're a Rifat Asad and you're superstitious, that's what you do. And therefore, because of this weird dream written up in this interrogation report in the middle of military war college, right, the Rifat Asad is telling you that because the commander of the Syrian divisions had a dream, therefore, the entire Syrian forces stop. Now, what's really freaky about this story is that there's a Gemara. The Talmud says that when Alexander the Great met Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Just, just outside Jerusalem, in the year 300 before the Common Era, the Jews of Jerusalem, including Shimon HaTzadik, who was the high priest, came out to meet him, because he's the new conqueror, and they're very nervous. And when Alexander the Great sees Shimon HaTzadik, so he jumps off his horse and he falls to the ground. And his men, his commander, say, what are you doing? You fall to the ground. What's the matter with you? It's just a Jew. And he says to them, every night before I go to battle, an old man with a white beard comes to me and blesses me and tells me which way I should attack. This is the face of that old man. And I'm studying this like 3 years later in Yeshiva, and I come across this Gemara, and I'm like, whoa. Did you hear that loud enough? Whoa. So if you ask most people why they stopped, they'll give you some story, whatever. But I have a theory that is a little bit different. Alright. We just came down off the top of Tzfat, which is the Mitzuda, the fortress that I'll tell you about later. You may have noticed it on your right. We're now driving through the newer part of town. Okay? This street that we're about to take a left on, this street is called the... It's basically... you can just see it by this arch. There's basically a Midrachov, like a... I don't know if the popular street where all the cafe houses are, and it's going to be coming up on our right. Okay, I'm just trying to orient you. Okay, look up on your right, and you'll see, like, if you're looking for like a coffee house and stuff like that, it's all the way up this closed to cars street. Well, it's supposed to be closed to cars. Now, by the way, look on your right. Look on your right. You see this wall on our right here?
Yeah.
Okay, these are all the buses that did not make this turn. So let's all give a hand to Moshe.
Yeah,
made it. All right. Now we're driving past. First of all, the new part of town, which is up on the right, there are sets of stairs all along here that go all the way up. So if you decide you do want to go up, you can climb up the stairs and find. Here's one on the right. There's another one coming up. You can climb your way up. You'll just have to come back down. Okay. The place where we park, unless I'm mistaken, is going to be the place where we get picked up. Okay? On your left is the entrance to the art gallery section, the artist quarter. Beautiful area to walk around. And ahead of us, where you see that big gray ugly building, that's the beautiful old city. If you are coming with me on an old city tour, we are going to start right on our left here. Okay? If you're coming with me on the tour, we're walking down this way. Okay, I just warn you in advance, this is very interesting to see, but just know we're going to walk down to that overview. Definitely worth seeing, but what goes down must come up. So that's just your call. Okay, I don't mind if you want to hang here, miss this. What? We're going to an overview. I got a couple stories to tell you.
You got stories?
Yeah, they're pretty mind-blowing, but... All right, a couple things. First of all, Tzfat is the highest city on a couple different levels, okay? First of all, it's the highest altitude of any city in Israel. We're up in the mountains, way up in the mountains. And second of all, if you walk around Tzfat a little, you realize you're in the crunchy granola capital of the world. This is the city of the mystics. By the time we finish this tour, you'll know why, okay? This is one of the four holy cities. The four holy cities, according to Jewish tradition, is Yerushalayim. Okay? What's the other three?
Tveria.
Tveria, good.
Yerushalayim.
Yerushalayim, I said. Yerushalayim, Tveria. What? Hebron? And Tzfat. There you go. Just seeing if your mom's paying attention. It's good. How many years of education, right? Anyway, what made Tzfat a special city? Do you know where Tzfat is mentioned in the Torah? Nowhere. Do you know where it's mentioned in the prophets?
Nowhere.
What makes Tzfat special, okay, is that the mystics came here to learn and to teach. But why did they come here to learn and to teach? There's a legend. The legend is that when Avram leaves the land of Mesopotamia and comes to the land of Israel, he's discovered God, but he's still got some work to do. Like, there might be somebody in this group who has decided that God really exists, is freaking them out, and now they need, what's your name?
Meir.
Oh, Livnot. Meimod. Avram comes here to study, and like, you know, maybe somebody, maybe one of you guys, you know, you kind of develop this relationship, you say, wow, you know, maybe Hashem really exists. Maybe God exists, that's great. And now what do you do with it? So we didn't really think about it on this level, but Avram might have been at that level. He's developing this relationship with God. He's got a lot of work to do. What's the recipe? Right? So he needs to go learn. Now, there were no yeshivas back then. Right? Wrong. There was one yeshiva. According to Jewish tradition, mystical tradition, there's a yeshiva called Yeshivat Shem Ve'Ever. And it was founded by the descendants of Noach. The legend is that the yeshiva of Shem and Ever sits on top of this mountain. There are two or three top archaeologists late night at the bar have a good laugh stories. This is one of them. Yeah, right. Abraham's yeshiva is up on the mountain. Until, I don't know, 25, 30 years ago, this is a longer story than we have time for, they're doing some digging up there, and they find something. And they find some relics, and these relics date back about 4,000 years. And they uncover this cave. And the cave has archaeological relics that they've been living in, you know, and lots of people have been living in there. And they're to this day not exactly sure what it is. The mystics had a field day with this, because the Kabbalists around here believe that that was the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Ever. So what you do with that, I have no idea. But I will tell you that Tzfat is one of the four holy cities. Walk around for an hour and you'll feel it. That's my guess. And nobody's quite figured out why, unless that story is correct. I'll tell you something else, by the way, which is really interesting. See this building? Do you notice there's like grass growing on the roof? It's a little dry. Why is there grass on the roof of the building? Right? Who plants a garden on the roof of a building? So this gives you an idea of what's been going on in Tzfat for the last 30 years. The reason there's grass there is because that used to be the level of the ground. This is all underground. Okay? Not here, but over there. There was a hill. And they started digging because they saw something, and they uncovered this whole building here. Okay? There are whole houses here that are underground that date back hundreds of years. In fact, there's an amazing program called Livnot Libanot, which we have someone here who works with Livnot, and there's a guy who founded it. You'll notice, I'll point it out a little later, what exactly Livnot is, but the guy who founded it, a guy named Aaron Botzar, he basically dug out his whole house. He lives in a house that's hundreds of years old, and he digs out a room every couple of years, and right now they've got about 7 or 8 rooms in there. He found a coin dating back to, I think, a Danish coin? Do you remember? Early Ottoman period coin in his house. Right? Okay. Like a 400 or 500 year old coin. He also found, but not exactly in his house, he found a coin that dates back to the Bar Kokhba Rebellion. And he has it in his house. You can pick it up and hold it in your hands. That's an unbelievable thing. Anyway, so we know where we're walking, but we don't really know where we're walking. But anyway, I just thought I'd slow down the descent. Come. Is this unbelievable? I want you to know that everywhere else in the world, I'm not really a graveyard hopper. This is the one exception. This place just blows my mind. No, I know groups that go to like Europe and they go from graveyard to graveyard. They come to Israel, they go to the graveyard in Tveria and the graveyard in Tzfat. I'm more interested. Right, I'm into battle zones, you know, whatever. Everybody's got their thing. But the Grateful Dead tour. But this is one of the oldest cemeteries in the Jewish world, and I'll tell you an interesting story about how the cemetery came to be known. First of all, just to what you're looking at, that's the mikvah of the Ari. I'll get to that in a minute. You ever hear of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai?
Yes.
Okay, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai brought Kabbalah, the Zohar, down into the world. He was lived in the time of the Romans. There's a Talmud in the Tractate of Shabbat, I think on 33, Taflam Gimel, that says that a few of these great rabbis were talking, and talking about the Romans. And one of them, I think it's Rabbi Yehuda, but don't quote me, if Michael will, says, you know what, the Romans are amazing. They built bridges, they built highways, they built bathhouses, it's unbelievable. And the second one, Rabbi Yossi, he doesn't say anything. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he says, what are you talking about? Of course they build bridges. They build bridges to collect our taxes. And they build roads to enslave our people. And they build bathhouses to take our women. So like everybody's shocked, because you don't talk about the Romans that way in public. So there's a stinker in the audience, you know, obviously there's people listening, and they let the Romans know. So the Romans agree that Rabbi Yehuda, because he spoke up for the Romans, he'll be appointed a governor in the area. Rabbi Yossi, he didn't denigrate the Romans, but he didn't defend them, so he's exiled to Tzipori, which ends up being fine for Rabbi Yossi, because that's where the Talmud Yerushalmi is written. But Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is sentenced to death. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai grabs his son, because he's also in danger, and they head out of there. And they basically head up to the area in probably the Carmel Mountains, not far from Haifa, that's one opinion. And they hide out in a cave. And the reason that's one opinion is because that's the cave where Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, hung out. And they learned Torah there for 12 years. And at the end of 12 years, you know, a voice comes from heaven, it's a whole miracle thing. A carob tree, an eighth charuv grows up, and a stream, you know, sort of miraculously come, and ravens come and bring them food. Unbelievable stuff, right? And they're living miracles. And they only have the clothes on their back because they have to get out of there in a hurry. So they take their clothes off every day, they bury themselves in sands up to their, like, torsos, and they learn Torah. And once a day, they put their clothes on and they dive in the morning. And then they get back into their pits. So all sorts of problems could develop, but they do learn a lot of Torah. They get out of the cave after 12 years, because a heavenly voice comes and says that the people who are out for you, you know, are dead. And they see this, you know, this guy, he's plowing his field. And Rav Shimon Bar Yochai freaks out, because he's been learning Torah for 12 years. How could you be plowing your field? You know, Menichan Chai Olam, Oskim B'Chai Yisha, you're leaving the life of the world to come, and you're dealing with this world, what's the matter with you? It's like, imagine you come off an Israelite trip, and you get back home, somebody says, hey, let's watch Friends. So you say, like, I mean, it's a nice experience, but, like, I just experienced Friends. Why would I want to watch them television, right? And you start saying to them, what are you wasting your life watching television? Of course, this person, it's not their fault. They didn't just experience what you experienced. So they're where you were 2 weeks ago, right? So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai can't handle it. He just stares at this guy, and fire comes from his eyes and kills this guy. So a heavenly voice comes out and says, Alach riva lami atzatem, you came out to destroy my world. So they're sent back into the cave. This time they're in the cave, not because the Romans want them dead, but because they don't know how to live in the world. They learn Torah for another year, and then they're told they can try it again, and they come out. And this time they see a guy running with two myrtle branches, and they ask him why he's running. And they say, because it's the eve of Shabbat. And so they say to him, well, why do you have two branches? He says, one for Zachor, one for Shamor, one to sanctify Shabbat, one to remember it. And they're all happy, everybody's happy, life is good, the story ends. So there are all sorts of mystical messages there about how we have to participate in the world and what it means. But that was Rav Shimon Bar Yochai. They don't tell stories like that about you and me. Rav Shimon Bar Yochai's grave is up on the mountain of Meron. You can see it. It looks like a saddle mountain. You can see on the right. Okay? If you ever do go to Meron, dare to do what the tourists don't do, which is to go to the top of the hill and to see a village which existed in the time of the Mishnah, which was destroyed by the Romans. And the most amazing thing is you can find a synagogue in that village because the mark of the mezuzah is still there. Unbelievable. From like 2,000 years ago. Pardon? No, that's around the thing. The kever, the grave of Hillel. Well, let's not get into Mount Meron. Hillel is buried on one side of the valley, Shammai on the other, but in order to understand that, you have to know Hillel and Shammai were. So I won't go there right now. But you can ask me on the bus.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.